Oh, man. Well, you know, one of the things that we do at Summit, obviously, is to talk about the life issue, because we think, we do it on Monday, by the way. The students come in Sunday night, and the first full day that we've got, Scott Klusendorf takes the stage, and we made friends a few years ago. It's a wonderful friendship. He and I, every time I'm going home to Texas, I stop in Atlanta, hang out with his family. We talk, and we talk strategy, or as Texas Republicans call it, strategery. Somebody should get that. But anyway, because we kind of, you know, we think that, the whole idea of you know, what are the unborn, basically ties in with the issue of relativism and all that. Whenever people try to skirt around that central issue, they usually try and get into shades of gray, basically. And relativistic thinking is sort of necessary these days. With all that we know about scientific facts and about philosophy, relativistic thinking is really necessary to maintain the pro-choice position. And so we try and attack that on the front end. And we sit down and we talk a lot about things, you know, and Scott decided after years of doing 3 hours of lectures at Summit on the issue of pro-life, he decided to shift to two and make his third hour on relativism and what's wrong with relativism, and then have me come back approximately 2 days later after he's laid the larger moral framework to basically come in and talk about specific arguments that people will confront and how to rebut them. And so what I'll do is I'm actually going to start with that portion of you know, what I do at Summit, and then I actually might then move into that other larger portion. It depends on what time we've got. I might kind of talk about some of the issues that Scott talks about as well. But I really enjoyed giving this talk called Killing Six Birds with One Stone about how, you know, what if you're in a situation where someone just attacks you with about six different, you know, half a dozen different pro-choice arguments, how do you gain control of the situation? And my understanding of how to go about this is influenced by my journey. You know, in the year 1993, the year that I was hired to be a professor at the University of North Carolina at Wilmington, the starting date for that job was August 1st, and I actually had my 10-year reunion, high school reunion, in July, and so I went home, and that was interesting because I finished 734th out of 740 in my high school class with a 1.8 GPA. I flunked English 4 years in a row. Now I'm a writer. That's hysterical. And people ask why, and you know, it's the whole reason for that was that I was a four-year letterman in high school, and I was actually being recruited to skip college and play professional soccer and go being recruited. I was thinking about playing in America. I was recruited by a team in Bolivia and all that, and I said, I'm too good an athlete for college, and just sheer arrogance, and what happens, I tear my Achilles tendon my senior year, and I had to go to college. I was forced to go to college. And look how much better it wound up. I mean, I just, my whole life was destroyed back then. I can't be a professional soccer player. That's all I wanted to do, basically. And so it worked out very well, because the North American Soccer League that I wanted to join actually folded about 5 years later, I think. And, it's so good. But people naturally freaked out severely when I showed up for my 10-year reunion. You're what? You're a professor? Seriously. What do you do, you know? And so I showed up for that 10-year reunion, but I was staying with my parents who were still living in the Houston area. And our oldest friends, the Chambers, we had this family that we grew up with where my mom and Lisa Chambers were best friends. My dad and Steve Chambers were best friends. And all the kids were best friends. We were like best families. Anyone have that growing up where you had like a best family, you know? And she was there. Lisa Chambers was there. And this woman was conservative, man. I mean, she was a very conservative Baptist woman. I mean, if she were Catholic, she would have been Attila the Nun, man. I mean, she was so conservative. And she knew that I had drifted into atheism. And I mean, it was bad because she'd corner me sometimes. And the last time that I'd seen her was after I graduated as an undergraduate. And I had my ring and it said liberal studies on it. And she said, "Yo, you got a degree in liberal studies." Actually, it was psychology, but they didn't have that. You had to get a liberal arts at that time. And it was just one, you know, for all the different liberal arts. And she just looked at me and she says, "Oh, that's neat. Do they have conservative arts?" And I would just sit there and go, "No," because she was right. And I was wrong. And it was destroying me on the inside. So what did I do? I avoided her, you know. But then we were stuck in the same house. And I knew she was going to corner me. And it was 1993, and I got stuck with her at the breakfast table.
And she sat there and she says, "Well, I understand that last year that you voted for Bill Clinton." And I'm like, "Well, I sure did. And I tried to, you know, I did my best to do a Clinton impression. But, you know, I was trying to make a joke out of it. But it just wasn't funny to her." She goes, "You know, that's our first openly pro-choice president. So I guess that you're pro-choice." And I said, "Well, I am, as a matter of fact." And she said, "You know, it's interesting. One of my sons has a girlfriend, ex-girlfriend, who was working for a crisis pregnancy center, and she introduced me to the concept of ultrasound technology. And, you know, as I was learning about it, I learned about this guy by the name of Bernard Nathanson. I heard his name. I hadn't heard his name before and found out that he was an abortion doctor, and he had actually aborted at least one of his own children after he got a girlfriend pregnant. And subsequently, he actually saw an ultrasound of an abortion taking place. And he realized, whoops, that the subject of that procedure is an unborn child who can actually feel pain. And so what he did was to make this film called The Silent Scream, which he published, or which he released, the same year that I graduated from high school in 1983. And she began to describe the film to me and said, "You know, it's interesting. You can see as the child tries to get away from the instrument of death that it feels the pain and actually opens up its mouth at the end of the procedure and tries to scream, but no one can hear the child." She said, "Yeah, you should watch that. Pass the salt or something." She has a 10-minute discussion with me and changes the subject. Now, how do we just end the last lecture? We talked about the need to read Greg Kokel. And if you read Greg Kokel, you realize that it's not your purpose in an argument with someone to go defeat them. Don't go out there trying to defeat them. We're in an argument. I'm going to defeat you. Then you're next. You're next. You're next. You don't sit there and try and just mow people down. What you try to do is plant a stone in their shoe. That's what Greg Kokel talks about all the time. You want to make them feel uncomfortable with their own position so that when they lean on their own position, they feel the weight of the discomfort. And that's what she did to me. And I was just so curious because it's a sad commentary, isn't it, that a college professor, someone can go and get a PhD at the age of 28, and they've taken all these courses, and I had taken courses in marriage and family and gender studies and things of that nature, and I had never confronted the central issue in the abortion debate, which is what are the unborn? It had never occurred to me. People just said, "Oh, it's a blob of tissue." I simply accepted that. And so I basically thought about it and thought about it and thought about it. And eventually I saw The Silent Scream and was very disturbed by that. And of course, eventually I actually convert on the issue of life. And I would actually become the advisor for the Pro-Life Club at UNCW and sponsor two separate showings of The Silent Scream on my own campus. The bad news in the story is this. Is that you can get a PhD and never think seriously about the central question in a serious debate. That tells you something about ideological diversity on our college campuses. But the good news is that if someone gets a hold of you for just 10 minutes and asks the right question, they can change the course of your life forever. I travel around the country speaking on the issue of abortion. And it's unbelievable. I wouldn't be doing what I'm doing right now if it were not for Lisa Chambers. And so that's the thing that we need to keep in mind as we have this discussion, is that we need to make sure that we are focused on the central issue in the debate. And what you'll find usually is when you are hit with this barrage of reasons for accepting the pro-choice position, it's because someone is begging the question. And question begging is one of those terms in our society that is very frequently misused. You know, begging a question doesn't mean raising a question. Oh, this begs the question. It brings it up. No, question begging is where you assume the very position that you're arguing about. We're arguing about the question of whether the unborn are in fact human. And when the other side just assumes that they're not, that's question begging, basically. And what we've got to do is to make sure that we do not allow them to do that. And so what does that look like when we're actually in a debate with someone? Well, we're going to walk through and talk about how to gain control of the situation by looking at some of the arguments that the other side makes. Now, this first argument that you see is, it's my body, my choice. And this is just foot stomping, you know, and it's emotional. You have to understand, though, that when someone shouts at you and says, my body, my choice, there is a very good chance that that individual has had an abortion. And so you've got to be very careful in the way that you deal with this. You know, at UMass Amherst, when I got up and gave a speech, a young woman got up and just started screaming that. And she was arrested that evening because she wouldn't stop screaming, basically. You remember the heckler's veto that we talked about. And there's just this raw emotion. And so the question is, when someone says, my body, my choice, how do you respond? I've got a way of dealing with this that I think is very important. It involves the showing of a short film. And what I will do when people say that, let's say we're having an email exchange, I will actually mail them this link. Or let's say it's on Facebook, I'll actually post that as my actual status. But there is, I want us all to get out our pens right now, because I'm a professor and I've got to be all assigning homework, and that's how I roll. But if you sit here and you write down www.caseforlife.com. That's case, C-A-S-E, four is F-O-R, and life, L-I-F-E. That is caseforlife.com. Now, some of you will recognize what that website is. That's the website for my good friend Scott Klusendorf's book, The Case for Life. And what happens is that when you click on that link, what pops up is this short 55-second film that shows the product of abortion, the aftermath of abortion. Now, this is better than the silent scream, I think, in some ways, because that's, you see the actual abortion taking place, and there's some kind of crazy music in the background, and it's a little bit rough to watch. But I think this is great because it's a short film. It's not narrated. In the background, all you have is some music. But what it does is to show the product of the abortion after 7 weeks, and then after 10 weeks, and then after 24 weeks. And after all the flesh tearing has taken place, it just kind of lays it out basically on a towel. And there is a little bit of blood, of course, and torn flesh. And this is abortion that we're talking about. So obviously it's going to be a little bit graphic. But it makes the point without gratuitous without a gratuitous graphic element, I would say. I don't believe that it's over the top at all. And people will look at that, and so many people who will watch that film are convinced that the third image of abortion after 24 weeks is the most persuasive, because you look and you see such a fully developed baby, and you can't look at that and say, well, that's not a human being, that's not a child. You can't call it a clump of cells. Fetus doesn't even work anymore when you look at it. None of that terminology works. But I am absolutely convinced that it's not the most effective picture. The most effective picture is the first one, because it's at 7 weeks. 7 weeks is very significant because doctors generally won't perform a surgical abortion until approximately 7 weeks after conception. Why won't they do that? Well, because there is tearing of flesh that's involved, and they are concerned that if it's too early, some of the flesh might actually be left inside the woman's body. And the result of that could be a deadly infection. So isn't that interesting? It's like, in order to save a life, we're going to wait until the unborn is a little bit more developed. Well, that's their reasoning for doing that. And so we don't see these surgical abortions happening till about 7 weeks. It's not really practical to get to the doctor and get it arranged and have that happen anyway till about 7 weeks. But the fact of the matter is that when you take a look at this film with the product of the 7-week abortion, you see something interesting. They tore off both of the hands, the doctor did. And both of the hands, because the skin is translucent, you can see through to the bone. And you can actually go and count 10 fingers. And this is absolutely powerful, because when someone comes to you and says, it's my body, my choice, your reflexive temptation is to talk about things in biblical terms, maybe to hit them with a theological argument. And that's not what you need to do. What you need to do is you need to hit them with basic medical information, and you need to hit them with basic philosophy and logic. And what you then do is you ask them, you say, it's my body, my choice. Does a pregnant woman have 4 hands and 20 fingers. And you see, you just look and you see that that's a separate body. And you might be in a Facebook situation where you can sit there and do that, but you might be in a face-to-face situation and you can't go to the film. So what would you do then? You would say, you know, there's some information out there, you know, some pro-lifers disagree about this. Randy Alcorn, in his excellent book, Pro-Life Answers to Pro-Choice Questions, says that we can detect a heartbeat after 21 days. Scott Klusendorf says it's 28 days. What do? You go with the most conservative estimate, which is 28 days. And you just ask a person, we can detect a heartbeat clearly after 4 weeks, and they won't perform the abortion till about 7 weeks. And then you use that basic medical information and you say, does a pregnant woman have two hearts? And what they begin to realize very quickly, see, I have people confront me with my body, my choice all the time, but they never stay on that argument. As soon as I give them that basic information, they always, I mean 100% of the time, that works. And they change the subject. Not to a different subject that's not abortion. They change to a different argument. You have confronted then an emotional argument and you've dismantled it in very calm terms. But that doesn't mean that the emotion is over. They're going to hit you with things like this. It's wrong to force a woman to bring an... Number two. Back alley abortions will increase if abortion is illegal. Okay, well, we're going to have back alley abortions. Okay, you stop and you think about just the morality of that. I mean, just how wrong-headed that is in a general moral sense. Well, what do you mean? You think you have a right to commit an immoral act under conditions of safety? You know, I mean, it just avoids the question altogether. You see the question-begging nature of all... That's what they did on the first argument. That's what they're doing here. You know, I shouldn't say this, but I desperately, desperately want to rob the Wells Fargo across the street from UNCW. I've been dying to rob that thing because I can get away with it, because I can just take a backpack and I can do it between classes and run back across the street and just blend. But you know, there's this, I'm really bothered, there's this fungus on the front sidewalk. I'm really concerned, like running out of Wells Fargo, I might slip and harm myself in the process. And so I'm going to call Wells Fargo and ask them to power wash the front sidewalk because I have a right to commit an immoral act under conditions of safety. I mean, you begin to think about how just strange it is to make that argument. But I don't want you to get caught up in that, okay? I want you to approach it in a different way, because this whole back alley abortion thing, you see, there was this guy who was the co-founder of NARAL by the name of Bernard Nathanson. Nathanson, before he converted on the life issue, and he became a Catholic, he became a pro-lifer and all of that after he realized what he had done, he would later confess that this old statistic that they used to use, which was that thousands and thousands of women would die every year as a result of back alley abortions, was false. He said, we made it up. We have no basis for it. It's just something that we invented. And it's like, oh, co-founder of NARAL says, and that's the source. He says, I lied. Okay, he became Catholic. He confessed. But the other side was not accepting the confession. And one of the problems is that we get caught up in this. You know, we sit here, I think there was actually a statistic in 1972, I think it might have been Centers for Disease Control, that said like 38 women died from illegal abortions the year before Roe versus Wade. See, I think that's wrong in the opposite direction. I think there's some underreporting. I think the thousands is made up, and I think like 38 is wrong as well. And the truth, of course, is usually lying in between the extremes. But we as pro-lifers get caught up in arguing, oh, how many was it? No, I don't think it was thousands. I think it was more like 999. Boy, do you miss the point entirely. If you want to get how to lay out this argument, if you're smart, what you'll do is you'll get this reference that I've got below. It says Principal Source Scott Ray, Moral Choices. That was actually the third edition, Grand Rapids, Zondervan, 2009. he's got a chart in there where he talks about the number of illegal abortions that were performed in the 1960s. And it's weird. You'll notice that in the 10 years preceding Roe versus Wade, that about 98,000 illegal abortions were performed in America. It doesn't say how many resulted in other deaths as well, but that's not where I'm going. You'll see where I'm going in just a second. There's this one outlier year. It's around 1962, where approximately 200,000 illegal abortions supposedly took place in the United States of America. I don't know why, but that's not important. What is important is that after Roe versus Wade became the law in the United States of America, within about 3 years, we had 1.2 million abortions in America. Now, that's important. Why do I stop the clock at 1.2? Because when abortion was illegal, the highest recorded number we had was 200,000. What do we have? Within just over 10 years, 10, 15 years, it jumps up to 1.2 million. By 1992, we'll see the peak in abortions in the United States of America. The figure will reach 1.6 million. So what you need to do is get familiar with the charts. What's the history of abortion in America? So that you can then return to the individual who talks about back alley abortions and say, okay, assuming that it's true that thousands of women died per year from back alley abortions in the United States of America, in some given year in the 1960s, ask them this. If thousands of women died from back alley abortions, how many hearts were stopped in the process? And then they'll say thousands, of course. Then you point to the figures. In 1992, there were 1.6 million abortions in America. How many hearts were stopped? Well, the answer is 1.6 million because all of those abortions took place, surgical abortions, after 4 weeks when you could detect the heart. Okay, why are you worried about this heart but not that heart? Okay, because I think if a heart's beating, what does that say? That means that you've got a living being. Okay, if they're unborn, it's not like it's a porcupine that turns into a human after birth. Okay, that's a living being, and they're in the womb. They haven't committed a crime because they're in the womb. Okay, if the heart is beating, they're living. It's an innocent human being. And how do the thousands weigh more than the millions? And then you've confronted the central issue. Without arguing, what's the number? Do you see the point? When you're generous with them and you concede on this disputed point, you still win the argument. That's something for you to think about. And I believe that Scott Ray's Moral Choices is a great book to lay out the larger moral framework. But they're not done. That's an emotional argument. Here's another one. Argument number three. It's wrong to force a woman to bring an unwanted baby into this world. Okay, and there's a tendency to want to focus on the word force. You want to look at that and say, hold on just a second. The abortion is an act of force. At no point am I wanting to put my hand on a woman's body and physically do something. I don't want to apply force to the woman. I want to remove force from the unborn child. So you want to focus on the word force. But I would argue that the key word in the argument is unwanted. See, it says, how can we force a woman to bring an unwanted baby into the world? The answer is there's no such thing as an unwanted baby. There is no such thing. Someone wants that child. Someone wants that child. But you will see what they're trying to say here. If we don't have the abortion, if we don't allow her to have the abortion, the child will be unwanted and may be subject to abuse. That's question begging, because you're assuming that abortion isn't child abuse. The very idea of saying we shall have abortion to prevent child abuse is like saying we need to decapitate people to prevent tooth decay. It is an unbelievably morally twisted argument. But as soon as you poke holes through the logic, you've really accomplished something. But you know what? We've got statistics as well. Oh, my goodness. Let's take a look at this. Okay, argument number two, you put Ray, a reminder. I'm going to look at Scott Ray's Moral Choices. Argument number three, I'm going to put the word Alcorn and abuse statistics or stats. That's Randy Alcorn's book, Pro-Life Answers to Pro-Choice Questions, because he has some stunning statistics in there. In the year 1973, there were 167,000 reported instances of child abuse in the United States of America, according to the Department of Health and Human Services. You don't need to write down all these statistics right now. You need to get the book. It's a great book because it's here. Oh, giddy up. That's awesome. What's interesting is as you read through that book, you'll realize 9 years later, in the year 1982, there were 929,000 reported instances of child abuse in the United States of America. Isn't that incredible? For those of you who can't do the math immediately, because you're not the Rain Man like me. No, I cheated. Okay, I used a calculator. That is a 556% increase in child abuse in the United States of America in less than one decade after Roe versus Wade. How do I interpret that? You see, Roe versus Wade, it's really interesting. Roe versus Wade, what did it do? It's like people said, oh, it just, people think that it prevented third trimester abortions and all of that, or it just allowed first. It's crazy, you know. If you read Roe versus Wade, it's unlimited in the first trimester. And in the second trimester, what do you have? Well, they're going to have health regulations and things of that nature. And then you move on to the third trimester, and what does it say? It says, well, you know, you can... The state can prescribe that and outlaw that unless there's some kind of a health concern. And then what do we have the same day as Roe versus Wade? We've got Doe versus Bolton. And that case says that a health justification doesn't have to be physical. It can be mental. So you get some doctor to say that the woman can't handle the stress of the child, basically. And then, boom, what have we got? We've just got unrestricted abortion, basically. And that's the reality of Roe versus Wade. And what does that say? It says that you can abort a fully developed child just because the child will inconvenience you or stress you out. That's the message. And so I look at that. For me, there's just no wonder at all that once we give a constitutional right for mothers to kill their children, that sends a message to the larger culture. Of course, we're going to have more child abuse. But, you know, the other side will respond to this, and they will say, oh, no, there are reasons why the statistics are like that. The government became more efficient at reporting child abuse right after that. Just right after that. That's incredible. If one of my students ever says to me that the government could become 556% more efficient at doing anything in less than a decade, I will sentence them to detention hall on a Saturday at the Department of Motor Vehicles. I'll make them sit down there and just have a face-to-face confrontation with government efficiency. And then they're like, oh, my bad, never mind. Well, there was greater social awareness of child abuse. Oh, really? So social awareness increased by 556% in 9 years. Okay, no. It's better for them to change the subject when they start to play that emotional card. Because if the purpose of abortion, if one of those was to reduce child abuse, it has failed and failed miserably in our society. So thank you, drive through. Move on to the next argument. It's wrong for a woman to be forced to bring a handicapped baby into the world. Praise God Almighty when they make this argument. Pray that they do it on Facebook. I mean, there are times when I haven't handled this very well with friends of mine. And I'll say, well, you know what I think we should do? I think we should get people in wheelchairs. And I think we should take them to the Grand Canyon. And just throw them off the side. Let them have a really good view of God's creation and then throw them off the side of the canyon, because a handicapped life isn't worth living. You know, the best cure for handicaps is just to kill people who have handicaps, you know. And I'll sit there and I'll say that and go, oh, that's stupid. That's not what I'm saying. I'm not saying we should kill handicapped people. We should kill people before they become Oh, my goodness. I walked right into it, okay? It's like they said, we should prevent handicaps through abortion. thank you very much for taking us right back to square one, ladies and gentlemen. You can detect a heartbeat after 4 weeks, but you can't detect Down syndrome till about 15 weeks. And I didn't say confirm it, but detect it. And, you know, we go back to the same question. At 15 weeks, what do you have? Man, you have got a very function. You've got all these functions that are developing and a beating heart and all that. You've got something that just clearly is human. And you've got this other problem. It's the error rate. I mean, I sit there at Summit Ministries and I'm just so moved. A young woman comes walking up to me, a 16-year-old, says, you know, I've got trisomy 13. And I said, no, you don't. You're like 16 years old. And she goes, you're right. But the doctor said that I did. And my mother took the risk. This kid comes walking up to me once, who's about 19 years old, about a 6'3" African-American kid who comes walking up. He's best volleyball player out there. He's making all the staff angry because he's beating them. We have this student versus staff thing. You can attest to that. If they lose, they become very unchristian when they lose in volleyball. We've had Summit students who were too good in volleyball just disappear for months. I'm just kidding. Afterwards, this kid was an awesome athlete, you know what? And he walked up to me and he says, I have cerebral palsy. And I said, no, you don't. He said, that's what the doctor said. And then that's what the second doctor said. And that's what the third doctor said. And the fourth doctor was a Christian. I said, I'm not sure. He didn't. Oh, my goodness. It's incredible. Let them make the handicap argument. They are absolutely begging the question and assuming that somehow being handicapped, that's a life that's not worth living. Anyone who knows a child with Down syndrome knows. They all report. They just enrich their lives. They're not worthless. They're different, but of infinite value to their Creator, without question. Let them make the argument. Praise God Almighty when they make that bad argument, and then they move on. A woman might not be able to afford a baby, or if she has one, might not be able to support another. Oh, my goodness. Trot out the toddler, ladies and gentlemen. Oh, this is just fantastic. When they make that argument, it's like, oh, well, you know, and it's always a crazy hypothetical. And because I teach criminal procedure, every day I come up with hypotheticals. Imagine your roommate has a bong and the police come after his marijuana. And I'll do these hypothetical scenarios. And was this legal or wasn't it? So I can't get too angry at people when they give me hypotheticals. You know, it's like I can't imagine a world without hypotheticals. That'd be another hypothetical. Imagine a world without hypotheticals. But, whoa, people who went to law school are like, yeah, I know what you're talking about. That's how we live, you know. I'm a professor. I don't live in the real world. I live in a hypothetical world. And so people will confront me and they say, well, imagine there's this woman and she has 5 children. But then she's pregnant with the 6th child, and then the husband decides that he doesn't want to support the child, just takes off, and she can't afford that 6th child. She's got to feed these other 5 children. Oh, my goodness, wouldn't you support abortion under those circumstances? And I'll say, absolutely not. You don't abort the child. You kill the oldest one. How sick are you? And a lot of oldest kids out there are going, looking at me right now, who are you right now? I liked you. What, are you the oldest child right now, Sarah? Because you're looking, this is turning your stomach right now. What is he arguing? Well, if that's the argument, if that abortion is justified to eliminate poverty, I got news for you. That older child eats more. They need a car. Their wedding and their college is closer. Kill the oldest one. It'll give you a few more years to save for college. And they go, they're like, oh, no, that's different. And you're like, oh, really? How so? And then you've got them to focus on the central. What is the difference? And what are the unborn? But the hypothetical varies frequently. Oh, it's a young woman, and, you know, she isn't prepared yet, so on and so forth. And so, you know, you don't want to bring the child. The child is just guaranteed to be poor. Well, you know, I try to remind people that the argument that it's justifiable to kill children in order to eliminate poverty isn't a novel argument. In the 18th century, the argument was made by Jonathan Swift. And he made the argument in a satire called A Modest Proposal. And I will tell people that they desperately need to read that. Because, you know, it's interesting. In England, the English are good at satire. But Americans are not so good at satire. I guess you could say we're not as swift as the British are. But we need to sit back and read those great works of satire. And I will say, you know what? Jonathan Swift was writing satire, but you're actually serious, aren't you? Well, no, it's different. Oh, how so? You see, what we've done is we've gotten them to the central issue in the bed. Because if the unborn are human, you don't kill human beings to eliminate poverty. You have to beg the question. You must do that. And so this is the procedure that we're working through, is to continue to direct them to the central question. And then finally, we realize when we hit the last one, it's cruel to force a victim of rape to bear the rapist's baby. You know, this reminds me, whenever I'm confronted with it, that all arguments in favor of abortion are not created equal. Some of them are much worse than others. I think they are at their worst when they make the handicap argument. I think it is positively the most cruel and bloodthirsty sounding argument that they can make. But they're at their best when they make the rape argument. Because sometimes they do actually mean it. Okay, now, what you need to do when someone confronts you with this, of course, is now often it's a single guy who's making the argument. It's like, oh, we have to have the rape exception. And the reality of it is that he's having sex, outside of wedlock, you know, and he wants to keep doing that. And he doesn't want a complete ban on abortion because he needs to keep living the way that he's living. And you need to figure that out, first of all. Is that person really serious? Is this intellectually driven or is it behaviorally driven? And so, of course, you ask them the question, well, if we were to sit down, could you and I come out and could we sit down and craft a proposal where, you know, one of us will sit here and write the ban on abortion, but the other one will come up with a rape exception? Would you agree to work with me to actually put that in law? And, of course, they never do because they're not serious about that. What they're doing is really an ugly thing, and that is victimizing rape victims a second time. Okay, it's like we've got these women who have been victims of rape, and now it's like we're going to prop them up and use them to justify our position so we can keep having sex outside of marriage. You realize they're just not really serious about it sometimes. But you know what? We need to go beyond just trying to call people's bluff, and we need to be in a position where we can actually make the moral argument. Okay, and the way that I make the moral argument is if I have a chance, an extended opportunity to sit down with someone and we've gotten this far and like that's the only thing that's holding them up on the issue, I've got a good friend, like, we're there. We've had this discussion over and over and over, and we are down to the issue of rape. And it's kind of cool because I can sit down with them and I can talk to them about Supreme Court precedent. I love to talk to them about the Kennedy case, Kennedy versus Louisiana from the year 2008. This was a shockingly bad, disturbing case. And I often tell people that they need to read Supreme Court opinions, and I tell them to be extremely careful when they actually sit down and read Kennedy versus Louisiana, because it is the most disturbing fact pattern I've ever read in my life. It involved this guy by the name of Kennedy, and he married a woman who had children, and he had like a 6-year-old stepdaughter. He begins having sexual intercourse with her when she is 6 years old, and he will rape her, and he will sodomize her. He will even torture her, and it gets so bad that it reaches a point where, you know, he basically penetrates the vaginal wall and she has to have surgery ultimately where she can never, ever have children. They barely save her life after this final incident that will ultimately lead to his arrest. But he blames it on her being gang raped by some teenagers in the neighborhood. And she's scared to death. And so she's covering for her stepfather, but they give two different stories. And this results in Kennedy being arrested. And the state of Louisiana convicts him of aggravated child rape, and they sentence him to die. And it raises an issue as to whether we can execute people for child rape. Well, it's really fascinating because in the year 1977, there was a case called Coker versus Georgia, in which the Supreme Court struck down the so-called ordinary rape statute that resulted in capital punishment. They said an ordinary rape, a common law rape, not a child rape, basically, that doesn't produce death, isn't punishable by death. You can't execute the aggravated rapist of an adult. Okay, they said it would be disproportionately cruel and unusual punishment. I disagree with that, by the way, because I think it's like, you know, murdering someone is that bad. The aggravated rape is right below it. And I think the punishment, to be an effective deterrent and send the right message, always has to be at least a little bit more serious than the crime. And, you know, I mean, think about it for a second. A person steals $100, you don't fine them $95. Okay, that's not going to work. Okay, and so I didn't agree with that decision. Okay, now here's what's interesting is that a lot of people, you know, I do support the death penalty, and so many people will approach you and they will say, oh, you're inconsistent. You're inconsistent is like saying you're fat and you're ugly. Okay, it's just an ad hominem attack unless they explain why. You're applying a double standard. It drives me completely crazy, and you guys know me. That's a short drive for me, of course. But it drives me crazy when people abuse the concept of the double standard. A double standard is when you apply two different standards to the same thing. Everyone knows that an unborn child and a convicted murderer are not the same thing. It takes severe mental gymnastics to reach that point. And again, I'll use that term, a severe intellectual hernia, to actually strain yourself into believing that that is in fact the case. Okay, so, you know, I tell people, whether you're in favor of the death penalty or opposed to the death penalty or undecided, your position on the death penalty doesn't affect the central question of whether the unborn are innocent human beings who have not been convicted of any crime and deserve no punishment whatsoever. So let's take that off the table. And let's talk about this issue of rape. Because in the Coker decision, they left open the question of whether or not we could execute someone for aggravated child rape. Coker didn't answer that question. And some statutes are on the books. One of them is Louisiana. And they will wait 31 years before they will look at a case and they'll say, this guy deserves it. We've got it on the statute. This guy deserves it. She barely lived. Well, the Supreme Court, in a 5-4 decision, which was authored by Justice Kennedy, no relation, obviously, they decided that the execution of the child rapist would be disproportionately cruel and unusual punishment. Okay, and so what it means is that if anyone is convicted of rape, they can't be executed unless the victim of the rape actually dies. Okay, so they save their life and, you know, that's it. So we have a strange situation in this country, don't we? A woman is raped and she has a constitutional right to abortion. The rapist has a constitutional right to life. The unborn child has absolutely nothing. That is the status quo. That is what they are defending, and that is what we oppose. And that is why you never run when they play that card of inconsistency on the death penalty. And that's the reason why you absolutely never run on the issue of rape. You need to talk about it carefully. You need to talk about it sensitively. But you need to talk about it. Don't back down when you get a person all the way to the goal line and they're there and they say, what about rape? Because something fascinating happened to me last year. I was speaking at Summit Ministries and I gave this talk and I finished the talk and then all of a sudden this young man says, can I speak to you on the front porch? And we walked out on the front porch, and he said, I'm with you almost. That was a good talk on pro-life. I'm with you. But this whole rape exception thing, you know, I just can't agree with you on the rape exception. He said, if a woman is a victim of rape, could you actually look her in the eye and tell her that you would not allow her to have an abortion, that she would have to have the rapist baby? And I said, first of all, that's not a rapist baby. That's God's baby. It's not a rapist baby. That baby does not belong to the rapist. But then I reached in my pocket and I pulled out my cell phone. And I said, do you know someone who's been a victim of rape and has been impregnated? Because if you do, I will call them on the phone. I will arrange to sit down with them and make the case. And just explain why I believe it's better to suffer evil than to inflict it. And so I said, I'll talk to this person. I believe I could look them in the eye. I'm answering your question. And he says, I don't know anyone who's been impregnated as a result of rape. I said, do you know any rape victims? No. I said, well, while I've got my phone out, I have a friend by the name of Laura. At the age of 32, she knew that she'd been put up for adoption. She's from Dallas, Texas. And she was always wondered about the circumstances. And she began to look into it. And she found her birth mother. And she sat down and she talked with her. And she found out that she was conceived in rape. And I said, will you talk to Laura? I'm dialing her phone number right now. I want you to talk on the phone with her. I want you to sit down and have coffee. I said, could you look her in the eye and tell her that she should have been killed? And he says, no, I don't want to have that conversation. I said, well, do you think she should be killed now? Of course not. That's absurd. Oh, what's the difference between the unborn child who's conceived in rape and the born child? He says, oh, you're doing that sled thing with me, aren't you? I said, yeah, we'll get to that later. And we sat there, and he just looked at me at some point, and he said, you know what? He said, I'm just wrong on this. And I wrote up our whole conversation in a column called Look Her in the Eye that's published on Clash Daily. And a very important component of the conversation is that I said, there are no problems and solutions in this world. There are only trade-offs. See, you think that a woman becomes she's a victim of rape and she becomes impregnated. You think that that's a problem and that the abortion is the solution, because that means that she will forget about the rape. And I said, she will never forget about the rape. There is no solution. You see, what we have here is a trade-off. You see, if she has the abortion, okay, maybe, you know, that becomes a lot easier for her over the next few months, as opposed to having that child and putting that child up for adoption. You see, it's like maybe some really seriously bad stuff. I'll concede definitely some seriously bad stuff is avoided. But you see, it's like you've got this advantage. And then over here, you've got a human life. You've got Laura, who's an adult, who's a friend, who has a successful business. You see, when you compare the trade-off, what you realize is it is better to suffer evil than to inflict it. Because we have this absolute moral principle that it is wrong. It is absolutely wrong to kill innocent human beings as punishment for the crime of another human being who is guilty. You see, and that takes us a long, long, long way. You see, when we begin to have these conversations with people, what we're really doing as we're dealing with this barrage on Facebook or this barrage in the women's studies class is we are taking control of the situation. We are getting in the driver's seat, and we are assuming a position where we can do what? We can get down to the central issue. And you see, if we are able to do that, what people will do is they'll realize that you can't deny that the unborn human, they're human. The unborn are in fact human, and they are in fact innocent human beings. But you see what happens so frequently in this debate is that people will sit there and say, well, they're not really persons with full rights. You will hear that. You're going to hear that. If you get into this, if you become a pro-life apologist, people will say human but not fully persons. And there are so many instances here where, you know, it's like we're asking ourselves, you know, if we've read Klusendorf's book and it talks about the SLED acronym, it's like, when do we use that? And many of you will realize in these arguments that I've actually built a bridge that you can cross with the SLED, basically, okay? Like when we were talking about the poverty thing, well, what was the difference, okay? That's a way to get to the SLED acronym. As we talked about this guy who said, oh, it wouldn't be okay to kill her now, but in the womb would have been different, okay? That's an opportunity to move into the SLED acronym. So I do want to take a few minutes to talk about the SLED acronym, because I know so many of you here know what it is, but some of you don't. And the reason why I want to talk about it is because I honestly and sincerely believe that pro-choicers have a choice. They can either support human equality or they can support abortion, but they can't support both of those things. And it really becomes evident when you ask them, you know, when you get into these personhood arguments and you get into the SLED acronym, because, you know, frequently people will sit there and you know what the SLED is. It's the four major differences where people are talking about four major differences between the unborn and the born that would justify abortion. And one of those things, and it makes the SLED so easy to remember, is it's a good acronym because the S stands for size. And you know that people will often say, well, they're smaller, basically. It's just this tiny little thing, okay? And it's like these are the kids whose parents did not show them Horton Hears a Who when they were little kids, you know, basically. But they will make that argument. And I'm always delighted when they'll say, oh, the unborn are smaller, therefore they have less in the way of rights. Well, it's easy to respond to that. Well, women, on average, aren't as tall and they're lighter. So, you know, what do you think? I mean, if the average woman weighs 80% as much as a man and is 80% their height, I mean, should they have like 8/10 of a vote, basically? I mean, what's the deal? I mean, are you arguing that Asian Americans don't have the same rights as African Americans because different races have different average heights? And, oh, I'm not arguing that. That's absurd. Yeah, you're right. That is absurd. The value of human beings is not a variable that varies along the lines of size. And I find very frequently in these arguments that people will abandon that. And then they'll move on to the L in the SLED, which is level of development. And I enjoy when they do that. Well, level of development. Okay, well, if people aren't as developed, then they don't have the same right to life. I mean, how does that work? Is that in the Geneva Convention? I mean, if we were to bomb New York City, basically, with all of these educated people and kill 1 million people, is that like a really big war crime? Okay, but if we go down to Lima, Peru, you know, where most people don't have formal education, and then we kill 1 million people there, and there's some educated people, I mean, can you bomb a less developed country, and that's less of a war crime? What does that mean? And let's compare a 2-year-old woman with a 22-year-old. Well, the 2-year-old, she doesn't have a developed reproductive system. Well, the 22-year-old does. The 2-year-old, well, she doesn't know how to read yet. The 22-year-old does. And the mental and moral development, the difference between the 2-year-old and the 22-year-old, is just tremendous. So what does that mean, basically? Are educated people, do they have a greater life value than people who aren't educated? And you see the basic problem they run into. If you argue that the value of human life is just a variable that varies with your level of development, you have made a mockery of human equality. Most of these folks want to call themselves liberals. That is not a liberal notion. And I find if you press back on this, they'll abandon it. But then you'll hear this argument that's crazy. There's this guy by the name of James Richards who has been writing me for years and years and years. And he says it's not a baby, it's not a person actually, until it actually gets out of the womb. I mean, till the absolute last minute before Earth. That's a non-person. And as soon as, imagine the consequence of the idea that you can travel 8 inches down a birth canal and that you can move a foot, and it's like person, non-person. If you're going to embrace that idea that you can move a foot and it changes your personhood status, man, you better be very careful before you take your next step. But being a person who teaches in the area of criminal procedure, I love to do hypotheticals. And one of the hypotheticals that I do is of these two women who are identical twins. One of them lives in New York City, and the other one lives in Los Angeles. Both of them are married. Both of them are 30 years old, and they've been having trouble getting pregnant. And after years and years and years, the Los Angeles sister calls the New York sister and says, I'm pregnant. Can you believe it? Oh, I was just about to call you. You know why? What a coincidence. We both got pregnant during exactly the same month, and we get to walk through and talk about this experience. And imagine they're living on opposite sides of the country. And then imagine, after 7 months, the sister who lives in New York City has the baby prematurely. Okay, she has this child 2 months early. And then the sister who's living in Los Angeles sees the picture of the child, and the child has some health problems, and the child is small and, you know, not as developed as they would like the child to have been. They wish that the pregnancy went to full term. And she becomes extremely nervous and extremely stressed out about having her child. She decides to have an abortion after seeing this circumstance unfold. You see, if she's stressed and if she gets the doctor to say that she has a legitimate health concern, and stress and psychological health concerns, not physical ones, count, she can have that abortion. You think about it. What's the difference? Can the other mother in New York just suddenly kill her child? What's the difference? You see, there's no difference. They're the same size. They're the same level of development. One's inside the womb, and one's outside the womb. You see, that's just not a legitimate moral argument. Size, level of development, okay? You have what? Environment. And then D, degree of dependency. I will, as long as I live, I will never forget this incident. When I got up, and there was actually a column I wrote about this called A Murder of One. And I was speaking at Clarion University in Pennsylvania. I was supposed to debate this woman who was the head of, she was a professor and the head of the Pro-Choice Club. And she actually prepared for the debate by reading my columns on townhall.com. And she said, I'm going to look at his arguments. She withdrew from the debate. And she told Mike Armstrong of the Leadership Institute, who was a graduate of Clarion University who set up the debate. Mike said, why did you drop out? She actually said, because I can't defeat his arguments. And she shows up at the, now it's not a debate. I had an hour and a half, just no debate, soliloquy. And I just got up there, and during the Q&A, this woman sat there, she's wearing a beret, and she had a coat on, and she's sitting down, and she says, I have a question for you. And she says, I don't want a sarcastic answer. I want to see. She obviously had read my columns. There's this space between people who appreciate sarcasm and people who don't. It spells sarcasm, basically, if you will. There's this difference between us. And she was on the other side of that divide, apparently. And she didn't appreciate it at all. And she says, I want you to answer the question. She says, if I have a child, and a child is living within me, and that child is dependent upon me, how can you force me to have this? If this child is dependent upon me, how can you force me to have the child? That just doesn't make sense to me. If the child can't live on its own, then it's not a human being. It's not a person. And so I stood up there, and this is what teaching these courses, this is where it helps. You can come up with crazy hypotheticals just on the spot. And I said, you know, you guys may not realize this, but I'm a gangbanger. I'm in a gang. And I'm up here in all my middle-aged whiteness, you know, talking about being in a Los Angeles gang and all this. And they're like, oh, this is stupid. Oh, here comes the hypothetical. Okay, they figured it out. And we're involved in this dispute. And I talked about a situation where there'd been a killing. And I'm doing a revenge killing as a member of a gang. And I'm driving by with an AK-47, and I unload a magazine into a bedroom, thinking that the bedroom is the rival gang member, but I get the wrong room. And in the next room, there are Siamese twins, and the Siamese twins are in the room, and I shoot and kill both of them. And I just asked the woman who was seated, I said, what's the offense? I mean, what are you going to charge me with? Is it going to be first-degree murder, or is it going to be second-degree murder, or is it going to be some form of manslaughter? What do you think is the appropriate level of homicide? And she says, well, I don't really know that much. I said, well, can you at least tell me how many homicides there are? And she says, well, it's obvious there are two. And I said, no, they're not. She goes, you think there are one? I said, no. There are zero. She says, that's an absurd position. I said, no, that's your position. You see, because they're attached to one another, and they are dependent upon one another. And if you're attached to another person, dependent upon them for survival, you're a non-person. You're not a person at all. And she just sat there. And I said, it's your position. So you can just kill them because they're dependent. I said, doesn't work out very well legally or morally, does it? In fact, it's cruel. It's the wrong position. I was amazed and blown away when she got up. She was pregnant. Oh, and I just said, oh my goodness, this just tells us how we have got to be prepared with an answer. Because it just sounded to me like she was considering it. And I was ready. And I want all of you to be ready as well. Do we need to take another break or go on for 15 minutes? What are your thoughts on this? I'd like to close things out, if we could just do it that way. And we can explain that in just a second. But what I'd like to do before we get to a few questions, and we will have time for some of them, is I want us to think about this for just a second. I mean, what is it that we're trying to do? Okay. What we're trying to do is to make sure that we're focused on the central question. You know, I really love something that Greg Kochel did, an analogy that he uses. And I want to ask all of you to think about this for a second, especially you young people who are thinking about being involved in the pro-life movement. I want you to imagine that, you know, you're not a teenager anymore, but you move forward in time, 10 years, and you are living the perfect life. You are in the kitchen doing dishes, males and females, both. I want you to imagine that you are in the kitchen doing dishes, and you hear the sound of your five-year-old child coming up behind you. And as you're trying to work, you hear this question. And the question is, Mommy or Daddy, can I kill it? Now, those of you who are laughing right now and thinking that this is kind of an absurd illustration obviously don't have children yet. Because this is a question, especially if you have young boys, that you will hear on a regular basis. And no one in their right mind would answer the question without doing what? Turning around and asking what it is. If they are holding a cockroach, have at it, scrub your hands very thoroughly, don't tell your mother. If they are holding the neighbor's cat, kill, I'm just kidding. If they are holding the neighbor's cat, you say, you know, put down the kitty and we need to have a long conversation about the possibility of psychological counseling. If they are holding their two-year-old brother in a headlock, you definitely need to have family counseling. But you need to ask the central question of what it is. And I believe that if you look at all the evidence that we've talked about, what you realize is that there's a thesis statement that we can really come up with and that we can have confidence in. And that is that there's no difference between adult human beings at that stage of development. There's no difference between them at that point and the time when they were an unborn child that would justify killing them at that earlier stage of development. We just can't come up with a difference that justifies abortion. But you know what the problem is? I just used that term earlier stage of development. An enormous problem is that people confuse construction with development. Now, I'm an old guitar player, and I supported myself when I was going through college. And in recent years, I supported myself playing music. And in recent years, I've decided to get back into music. And one of the coolest things I did a couple of years ago was to buy my first Mesa Boogie amplifier. This thing is an awesome, awesome amplifier. And when I opened up the box, and I looked at the instructions, there was a note in there that said that they actually give guided tours of the Mesa Boogie amplifier factory in Petaluma, California. As God is my witness, before I die, I am going to that factory, and I am going to see how they put this awesome thing together. And I know when I do that, I'm going to see that they start with two pieces of birch, and they put the two pieces together. That's the first thing they do. It's not an amplifier. Once they put all the wood together, then they've got to fasten in the speaker. But that's not an amplifier. They've got to put the wiring in. It's not an amplifier. And then after that, they've got to put all the knobs on it. And you had better believe that my volume knob goes to 11, because 10 is simply not enough. At some point, as they are constructing the amplifier, it will become undeniable that we have an amplifier. But you see, human beings are not put together the same way. If you want to understand the crucial difference between development and construction, you see, I need to go back to the year 1973. It's not just the year that Roe versus Wade was decided. It was the very first year that my parents in Texas took time off and allowed me to go on a family vacation with the whole family all the way to California. And I will never forget going to Carlsbad Caverns, to White Sands, and my favorite place in the world, which is the Grand Canyon. And this was 1973, and so you know what we had. We had an awesome digital camera. Just kidding. We had a Polaroid. And I stood there over the deepest part on the north end of that canyon, and I remember taking that picture. And it was just unbelievable. Because it comes out, and I'm looking at it, and it's this little tiny dot. It's not very pretty. It's this brown dot. That's all it is. And then it just grows, and it grows, and it grows into something incredibly complex and beautiful. You see, that's the way that we develop. You see, we develop ourselves from within. When I talk about that heartbeat, I'm not suggesting that life begins when your heart beats, but I focus on that heartbeat because it is irrefutable evidence of something happening before the surgical abortion takes place. It is a living being actively involved in developing itself from within. You're here today because someone left you alone and allowed you to develop. We have a moral obligation to do the same thing for others. Through the force of moral persuasion and indeed the law. Because all law has a moral basis. And the most moral law is the one that defends those who are unable to defend themselves. That's why we fight in the courts of law. And that's why we fight in the court of public opinion. And I'm so glad I'm here having this discussion with you, because someone took 10 minutes to sit down and cut to the chase and cut through to the central moral argument in the debate. And thank you for listening.
Oh, yeah. Well, I get the first question. A little privilege here. How many of you were here when Greg Kokel was here? Okay, then you'll understand my question. Exactly who infected who? Did you infect him or did he infect you?
He's responsible. Yeah.
You two think a lot and alike, and I appreciate it. Questions? You'll have to probably shout loud. We can't get to the... You had the first question.
I'll announce it. Yeah, I'll just say what the question was since I heard it, and it's a very common one. The question concerns ectopic pregnancy. Basically, and how do we deal with that? And, you know, folks will sit there and say, well, you know, if you oppose the rape exception, oh, aren't you opposed to abortion in the case of ectopic pregnancy? Absolutely not. Okay, I am not opposed to it, and here's the reason why. Obviously, when a embryo is developing outside of the womb, inside of the fallopian tubes, what do we know is going to happen? We know that both individuals are going to be killed. Obviously, the fallopian tubes are going to burst. This is going to kill the woman. And, of course, the unborn child cannot survive under those circumstances. And, you know, what I hear very frequently is that, you know, students at Summit, for example, will say, instead of doing, isn't that the same thing? Well, no, there's a difference between intent and foreseeability. It's not your intention to kill the child. You foresee that happening, and that is an enormous moral distinction. You foresee that happening, but you don't intend it. Your intent is to save one life while you can, and that's a very clear moral choice. And some of the students will say, well, why don't you pray for a miracle? Boy, I'll tell you something. There's a huge difference between prayer and presumption. You see, what you're doing in that case is that God has presented you with a clear moral choice there. Two people are going to die, or you're going to save one of them. And what you're doing in that prayer is to say, you know, I don't like doing this thing that I'm compelled to do because the moral law is written on my heart and I know what the right thing to do is. I want you to take that away from me. And I don't believe that that's moral at all. So the ectopic pregnancy, because it is not intended to kill, but it is simply death that is foreseeable, is in a completely different moral category. That's my answer to the question. Yes. Thank you. Because it always comes up in the open sessions at Summit, and it's great. Okay, you've got to come up and ask the question.
You didn't mention something that, from a criminology point of view, I would think that the presence of separate identifiable DNA indicates a completely separate person. Yeah. So a person cannot say, this is my body only.
Right. Yeah, that DNA argument is it's just another good argument that you can use. And the reason why I don't go for that usually is because the film Case for Life, it's like I go with what they can see, the visual, and because they can't see the DNA and they can see the body parts, I choose that. But that is, morally speaking, and equally persuasive. You know, it's the same body, really. I mean, did they arrest O.J. Simpson's mother? I hate to bring up O.J. Simpson because he was so obviously innocent. Just kidding. Okay, but at any rate, it is indeed a compelling and persuasive argument. I think it's correct. And I just kind of do what is the companion argument to the video.
My question is to do with the labeling theory.
Yes.
I believe in free will. I think some statements you made really challenged me in a good way, but I'm not fully convinced, I guess. And that is that when people, like I've watched a kid who was basically labeled by his father with pretty bad things, and it seemed like it was definitely affecting his behavior.
Yeah. I can definitely give an answer to that. It's interesting. I thank you for raising that. I've done a lot of survey research. As you can tell, I think that cross-sectional research in criminology is garbage. And so what I did for my dissertation, although it took a lot longer, is I used panel data following youths for a period of 5 years. And what you find is that labeling theory is not totally worthless. What you're really arguing is, hey, I think in some cases that it might be the case that a person really can be so badly labeled that it really actually exerts an effect on their behavior. That's true. But what you find is that when you straighten the causal ordering out and you follow people over several years and you measure their delinquency every year and their labeling levels, what you just find out is that influence is almost non-existent. In other words, it's very small. So there are people like someone that you know that you just mentioned, but it's a very rare case. And so in order for us to say that free will exists and it's dominant in the course of people's lives, we don't have to prove that it's the exclusive factor. And so what I'm trying to say is that, you know, all of their theories are not total garbage. Pretty close to it, though. Okay, so there are some extreme circumstances, indeed. But, you know, their levels of explained variance, I don't want to get into academic speak, but whenever you do regression models and you're out there applying statistics and you're looking at different variables and how they correlate with other variables, there's this thing called the R-square at the end of the day, and that is your theoretical model. How much variance did it explain? And I actually just wrote an academic paper on this. It is embarrassing. In criminology, most papers don't report the explained variance because they want to hide it. And usually it's less than 10%, all of the factors combined. And so what does that tell you if there's this huge residual? It simply says that free will does. It implies it plays a major role in the criminal career path. Good question. Okay.
Come on up.
Well, I do believe that we need to take a stand and act on it, regardless of whether we're a student or an adult out in the world. But if I were a student again, my question is, or my assumption is, if I ask these questions to my professor, I am going to automatically put him against me. You know, I'm going to set the stage for that. But for the sake of my peers and also to make a point, I believe it is important to ask those questions. So how would I bring the two together, academic excellence as well as confronting the professor, bringing the two together?
Right. Yeah, let me step up and
make sure the microphone gets this. The biggest problem on campuses, I think, is it's coming from the administrations and the policies, because they just wipe out things, you know, in mass, in one fell swoop. You know, it's like they can damage a lot of people with one or two decisions. But you still do have these in-classroom decisions. You still do have these situations where you have the retaliatory professors. I would say this. You minimize the chances of that taking place by asking questions instead of making assertions. They're less threatened by the questions, basically. And you can ask them in a way that's fair and that's not rude, and you can minimize the chances of that. But there's another way of dealing with it. You can sign up for the class with some friends. And you can take turns. And a few years ago, I had a few libertarian students who heard of this crazy feminist professor in social work who was just all about the government raising our children for us. And she was just this massive government interventionist. And they signed up in mass. And the professor gave all of them D's. Some of these kids had never had a B before. And so they were able to go en masse and say, you know, something interesting took place here. We're all libertarians. We have a different worldview as opposed to this professor. No one else agrees with us. No one else challenged the professor. We did. Here's our transcripts and here's our grades. This can't possibly be a coincidence. And the department chair in that case, I will publicly give him credit, Nelson Reed, he overturned the decision and gave those kids A's and said, I see what happened, and I'm sorry that you went through this. There's strength in numbers. That was brilliant. That was my idea. I'm kidding, it wasn't. I so want to steal it. It was one kid who thought of it. It was fantastic. Yep.
On the subject of abortion, if you're debating with a leftist and you use these arguments and you explain to them and they understand that it is a fact of human being made in the image of God, and they understand that, does that change their mind?
Right.
What you want to do is you hold off on the argument that human beings are made in the image of God. You hold off on that in the debate with an atheist, because you know that that's not going to be persuasive. You probably don't make that a part of your argument, but you know what? Sometimes they'll ask you. And actually, later on in the Q&A at Clarion, same place, there was an atheist out there, and he just looked at me and he says, well, who says murder is wrong? He says, what gives human beings value? And I said, okay, well, now I have to answer, you know, with a religious response. They're made in the image of their creator. That's what I believe. I said, we can't fully escape from the argument. You know, we can't fully escape from that. But he said, well, thank you for being honest with me. And you hold off on that, and then if they ask you, they ask you. But, you know, related to that, I want people to understand that you will get into a situation with someone who's not a believer and doesn't believe that human beings have value, and they will actually ask questions like that. He was asking it in a different spirit. He was trying to raise that issue. What's wrong with murder? Some will ask the question, what's wrong with murder? Because they're not sure there's anything wrong with murder. And what we need to understand is that there's a small percentage of people who will never be converted on the issue of life. So what do you do with them? You argue with them in public so that when they say, politely, but when they say, I don't see anything wrong with murder, you might convert 10 people to the pro-life cause, because they'll look and they say, I see where this is leading. I don't want to be one of those guys. Thank you.